Morning. So we are continuing in our conversation around the book of Romans. And as the lectionary has progressed, we've made it to now the end of chapter 7. Chapter 8 is the sweet spot. And much to my, I say this tongue in cheek, much to my broken heart, because especially as a Lutheran pastor, Romans 8 is like the best chapter in the Bible. I actually am going to have to pass that on to Pastor Neil Groling because I'll be out of town. So what a bummer. I know. You're in good hands. Nevertheless, as Paul is now, he is building up to right towards the climactic moment of the argument that he has been laying out for 7 chapters, he gives us what is seemingly very clear and easy to understand, the inner struggle of a human being. And I say seemingly hard to understand or easy to understand because there's actually a fair bit of controversy in the bunch of, you know, the realm of New Testament nerds as we try to figure out what exactly Paul is saying here. Because on the one hand, you hear it and it just makes sense. Like, the thing that I want to do, I end up not doing. And the thing that I don't want to do, namely because it's wrong, I end up doing, and as our image here shows, the struggle is real. And I don't know a single person who will not resonate with that statement. And if you are a person who does not resonate with that statement, I would be pretty worried about you. But as we've seen with the book of Romans, not everything is as it appears. Because by way of very brief recap, he's been trying to pull together 2 factions within the Christian church, as we would call it today, in the city of Rome that had been separated for maybe a decade, namely the Gentile converts to Christianity and the Jewish believers in Jesus, so Jewish Christians. They'd been separated for some political reasons. There's a whole backstory there. We're not going to get into it. But when they come back together, they struggle. And so Paul has to, and he spent 7 chapters to do it, lay out a case that neither position or neither background is privileged to the extent that they are better than the other. So if you're Jewish, that's great. You're bearing the covenant made with Abraham very long ago that God will be your God, you will be his people, you will bear this promise, and through you, all the nations will be blessed. And you are given the gift, and note it is considered a gift of Torah, or God's law, or teaching, or whatever. And so we can assume that they've been following Torah, law, all their lives. And then at the same time, yeah, the Gentiles, yeah, they took a different path, to say the least. And at the same time, God has been slowly revealing himself through nature and that kind of thing. But ultimately, they still have this sense that there are things you do, things you don't do. They just don't have a name for it. And as we've gone through chapters 6 and 7 up to this point, Paul has said that and argued that the law, God's, standards, God's requirements, and maybe a more modern way to say it is what it means to be truly human in the best, truest sense of the word, that we cannot live up to it, and the law has a tendency to show us that. So if there were no speed limits, God help us all in Albuquerque, not like they do a ton anyway, we would just drive like crazy, not realizing that that would be incredibly dangerous, assuming we have no common sense, which, you know, whatever. But then all of a sudden the speeding signs go up and you realize, oh, I've been breaking the law this whole time. The law has a tendency to do that. It also has a tendency to keep you safe, to keep things kind of contained, keep the chaos at a low roar or something like that. The problem that we run into as Paul starts saying, look, the good I want to do, I don't do. The bad that I don't want to do, I end up doing, is that we have a tendency to read this as though it immediately applies to us right now as followers of Jesus. And it does resonate with us. But if you track Paul's argument, that's not quite what he's saying, although he isn't not saying that. It works on a multiple levels. If that's confusing, good. We're all in the same place now. Because what Paul is saying from the first person perspective is the plight of the person, the human being, before Jesus. Before Jesus, but at the same time recognizing that something has gone wrong. And I don't know a single person that would look at the world around them and say, this is absolutely perfect. Nothing has gone wrong here. This is clearly what is intended. Of course not. No one's going to say that. And so what Paul is now drawing out of that just brute observation is the reality that, like, setting aside any other standard. So take a moment and set aside any laws of the state or any divine laws, you know, like the big ones, like don't murder, don't steal, don't covet, that kind of thing. That human beings will always have standards that they set for themselves. And I'm willing to bet, setting aside anything to do with the life of faith or anything to do with this weird desire to not go to jail, that you, as a human being, you have standards that you set for yourself. Things like, you want to be a good friend. You want to love and honor your spouse if that applies. You want to love and raise your children well. You want to be a good citizen. These are all possibilities. You want to work hard. You want to be successful. You want to give everything your all. You want to make sure to take care of yourself. You don't want to be too hard on yourself. You maybe don't want to judge yourself too harshly because that's a miserable existence. All of these are possibilities for the standards that we set for ourselves. And I'm willing to bet all the money in my wallet, which isn't much, but whatever, is that you can't live up to your own standards perfectly. That's just a reality. And again, that's why as Paul says what he says, it just resonates with us. But he's more directly, or more based on context in the moment, speaking to the situation prior to the coming of Jesus. Because as followers of Jesus, we have, to put it maybe a little bluntly, we have a way out. But what if you didn't? Then you're just stuck. You're left alone. You may be conscious that there are standards set by society, maybe even divine standards set that determine how you ought to live and, frankly, what would be a better way to live. But you can't do it. So what do you do now? And as Paul has built all the way up to this moment, and really right peaking right in chapter 8, is the fact that even if you live a life of faith, so to the Jewish contingency in his community, which would probably be more easily comparable to us, that yeah, they've had this law, they've known better, they have had the benefit of living life under a God who has demonstrated himself wonderfully faithful even though we are faithless, very forgiving even when we absolutely do not deserve that forgiveness. And yet, at the same time, we can't seem to move the needle. And that's an extremely frustrating way to be. And I've talked about this as we've kind of gone through Romans. There are a couple of ways that we can handle it, and most of them don't work. Now, don't raise your hand. I can't stop you. Imagine here or think back on your own experience. if you grew up in a church where the culture or the pastor or whomever would just hammer you in order to change your behavior. I said something like that a couple weeks ago and got a lot of comments going, oh, that was Pastor so-and-so growing up back in, you know, wherever they grew up. And you could just see the heaviness, the frustration, the regret. It's not a fun experience. And the problem is that it doesn't work. Like, if I got up here and started picking certain sins that you're guilty of, I'm guilty of, whatever, and just started bashing you for them and explaining to you all the ways that they are bad and not and going to destroy you and everyone around you, you might come to the point where you agree, but with no real out, no real change, no real, reversing our mentality or changing the orientation of our soul, things aren't really going to change that much. And at worst, we're just going to drive those kinds of behaviors down below the surface, and that's even worse. And so as Paul makes his way to through chapter 7, he is explaining that both Gentile and Jewish contingency in his church are stuck, and so are we. The analogy or the connection is not hard to make. I mean, take some of the things that Jesus said. Because he gave laws or expectations that are couched as, this is the new reality, the kingdom of God, and there are certain things we do and do not do here. And typical Jesus, he just made things so much more difficult. Things like, you've heard it said, love your neighbor. But what about praying for those who persecute you? Can you love the person that hates you? I mean, theoretically. I know some of you can because you like the Packers. But... it's a cheap joke. I have nothing against them. But, especially at a time where political tensions just are at an all-time chaotic high, can you love the person across the aisle? Can you honestly say that you're willing to pray for whoever that political leader is that you just cannot stand? And there are many options. That's a lot harder. Can you turn the other cheek? In other words, can you respond in such a way that you may get harmed as someone intends to harm you, and yet do so in a way that maybe by your lack of resistance, you can show them that there's a different way to live? None of this is easy. Can you hear the commandment, love your neighbor as though they were yourself, and not immediately ask, like was asked of Jesus, but who is my neighbor? In other words, who do I have to love? I'll admit, none of those are easy. Add on the complications of life, and the difficulty that just comes when you have more than one person in the room, let alone trying to live in a relationship with other people, we're going to find ourselves not measuring up at all. And the reason why I bring specifically those teachings of Jesus is that they represent his interpretation of God's law. So long before his death and resurrection, when the story changes quite a bit, he puts forward a truly beautiful and amazing way to live as God intends. But he does so in a way that we cannot help but tell ourselves, I can't live up to that. Because if I can't even live up to my own standards, which are far from perfect, I definitely can't live up to God's standards. So we are stuck. left to ourselves. And there, especially in a modern culture, we've got some therapeutic ways of trying to work our way around that. We can define the supreme being, find our identity in some sort of outside influence, other religious experience, non-religious experience, the denial of any religious experience. We can find maybe some comfort and some answers in psychology or philosophy or something like that, but it all just tends to feel very thin, because the foundation of all of that is ultimately just built on ourselves. And I don't know about you, but I would not trust a single foundation that I myself built. I do not know how to pour concrete, metaphorically and, just actually. And so now we get to chapter 7 as Paul makes his way through. We come to resonate with the experience that the good that I want to do, I can't. Or I can try, and sometimes I can do okay, but ultimately I'm a failure. The things that I know are going to harm myself and those around me, that will damage my own soul, that will dehumanize myself and others, things that will just poison me, I still end up doing. Now, that can be a way of just resonating with the frustration of knowing that there's a better way and not being able to do it. But up until this point, I think Paul's ultimate goal is to depict life before Jesus. And we know this because right after Romans 25, or chapter 7, verse 25, we have Romans chapter 8, verse 1, which says, "There is therefore now no condemnation for those in Jesus." In other words, to look at the frustration and struggle that Paul describes and to say, I resonate with that to the extent that that is my current and present reality and identity, is a category mistake. Because while that struggle will still exist, and Paul has other ways to talk about it, which he does later. Although we may resonate with that, it is not who we are any longer. And this makes a whole lot of sense, because by this point, as Paul's readers are engaging with this monstrously complicated letter that is so multi-layered that we are still puzzled by parts of it today, that they would ultimately realize, whether they are Jewish or Gentile or just trying to figure out how to live life together under this wild idea that God sent his son Jesus, that inner struggle, that inner conflict that we experience is not who we are anymore. That instead we are bound to Jesus. He's had many ways to suggest that this is our reality. In chapter 6, he said that in baptism, you died with Jesus. And if you die with Jesus, it means that sin and the evil that abounds within doesn't have a claim over you anymore. But if you die in Jesus, then you are raised to new life in Jesus, which means that you live in that new reality. Which is why he can say in chapter 8, verse 1, there is no condemnation for those who are in Jesus. Now sit with that for a minute, because it's easy to get complacent or just want to explain that away, especially if you're the type that's really hard on yourself. And again, don't raise your hand, but I assume I'm not the only one here. There's no condemnation. And notice that he doesn't then give a bunch of contingencies for that. He does not say, there's no condemnation from God to you if you are in Jesus, so long as you go to church every week, or so long as you tithe your salary, or so long as you spend X number of hours helping each other out, or serving at the church, or cleaning my office if you don't mind. just going to throw that in there. There are no qualifications. There are no contingencies. There is only no condemnation. But can you accept that? Can you live with that? And I say that because we as human beings, and I think I said this 2 weeks ago, everything we do is evaluated. Everything we do is measured. Regardless of your role or vocation or wherever you find yourself in life, you are being evaluated in some way. Can you really live in the reality that through God's eyes, that's actually not true? This is why the way of Jesus is complicated. It's difficult. Not because it gives you a set of standards that you can't follow, but rather because it sets you up to rethink and reevaluate every way that you have ever perceived reality. Because to live life as a human is to be evaluated. It's to have a rubric applied to you. It's to have adjectives like good and bad or mediocre applied to your performance, to your character, to your bank account, to your house, and to the cars you drive, and the kids you raise or the spouse that you may have. All of that is completely moot. It's completely irrelevant because there is no condemnation in Jesus. Period. That's a scary thought. It takes away our sense of control and places it entirely in God's hands. It takes away our hope that we can justify ourselves, that we can pat ourselves on the back. I don't recommend that because it's not going to work out so well. Because why would we even bother trying to justify ourselves before God when Jesus has already done it for us? Now, ironically, that freedom is more likely to enable you to live under the standards that Jesus sets out. Because those standards, if they don't come with a threat and they don't come with condemnation, but rather with gentleness and compassion, are much, much easier to follow because they completely take away the fear of failure. So while everything leading up to this moment in Romans chapter 7, as Paul lays out, is this frustrating analysis of what it means to be human and how hard it is to live as a human being. Finally, we get to the moment where we can take a breath because there's no condemnation. You are not condemned because of what Jesus accomplished for you, his death, his defeat of death and the resurrection, and the giving of his spirit to you. So whatever ways you may evaluate yourself, whatever ways you might find that you are being evaluated in every realm of life, there is no condemnation from God. That's not only a freedom in which you can really truly live, it's also a freedom that will make relationships and living in community, in unity, much easier. Amen. As you are able, please rise.